The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of The Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us, danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes. Twitter, at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. Former President Barack Obama, I thought, gave a wonderful eulogy at John Lewis's funeral. Wonderful in the sense that he reminded the nation what a divisive demagogue and affected fraud he was as President of the United States and continues to be as he works to advance racial discord in America. He has been as a public figure. You can be divisive and demagogic and still speak at room temperature. Those things are not mutually exclusive, and President Obama proved it with this comparison to police officers in 2020 America. 2020 America, as per the left's position, part of the identitarian hustle, no different than 1963 Birmingham.
Bull Connor may be gone, but today we witness with our own eyes police officers kneeling on the necks of Black Americans.
That right, 2020 America and 2020 policing in America, no different than Bull Connor in Birmingham, Alabama, almost six decades ago. Nothing changed. You know, I have to use the fake affectation the way that President Obama does. Tucker Carlson, I thought, had a trenchant response to not only that comparison that President Obama made, but also his infusion of partisan politics at a eulogy. In a eulogy that really had nothing to do with John Lewis. It wasn't like we're going through John Lewis's accomplishments from his perspective as a member of Congress, in addition to being a civil rights leader in the 60s. He was talking about things like the filibuster, Carlson's comment.
Imagine if some greasy politician showed up at your loved one's funeral and started throwing around stupid partisan talking points about Senate procedure. Can you imagine that? You would be shocked if that happened. You'd probably walk out. Desecrating a funeral with campaign slogans? What kind of person would do that? But Democrats in the audience didn't seem offended. They didn't blink. They cheered. It all seemed normal to them. And why wouldn't it? Political power is their religion. It's not out of place in a church. It's what they worship. People who will politicize a funeral will do anything. And they're trying to. Democrats are working systematically to dismantle the core institutions of American life.
And they're doing a pretty bang-up job since they're in charge of most of those core institutions, aren't they? Just going back to the all police are Bull Connor. I mean, he didn't say all, but the implication is clear, particularly with the lack of specificity. And, you know, this is the most dizzying intellect the Western world has ever seen. It's one thing if a troglodyte like Trump is imprecise with the English language, which he has very little command of. But for someone brilliant, for the greatest mind in American history, according to many, certainly that's how he was covered. You know, that lack of precision can't be seen as a mistake, a failure. It has to be seen as purposeful. Bull Connor may be gone, but we still have police kneeling on people's necks. Mm-hmm. And this is against what backdrop? Andy Ngo, reporting from Portland. There have been 22 homicides in Portland since June 1st. In all of 2019, there were 36 homicides. Last month, the mayor there, Ted Wheeler, dismantled the gun violence reduction team because he and others said it was unfair to blacks. Probably unfair to blacks to be victims of gun violence at the hands of violent predators, too. But, okay, 22 homicides in Portland in the last 2 months. In 2019, there were 36 homicides. And, of course, we see this all over the country. Seattle, Chicago, New York, the increase in crime. And the problem, as has been explained by Lori Lightfoot and all these big city mayors, as has been countenanced by Joe Biden and federal Democrat Party poobahs. The problem is police, specifically federal law enforcement, but police in general, federal law enforcement when it's dispatched to urban centers. That's who we need to be worried about, because they're just a bunch of Bull Connors. They're out there turning hoses on black children trying to go to school. That's mainly what the police, and including federal law enforcement, do in this country in 2020, isn't it? People forget because they, you know, have stylized memories of people they like. President Obama elected in 2008, takes office in 2009. A lot of hope for change, to borrow his two-word candidacy. And optimism about the improvement in race relations in this country, first black president, right? And then if you recall the survey results when Obama was on the cusp of leaving office, race relations and people's perception of race relations had significantly declined, become significantly more pessimistic after 8 years of the first black president of the United States. Why? Because he was the divisive demagogue that I described at the outset. And now that's frayed even more because of the identitarian politics of the left, the neo-Marxism that's all dressed up to look like a fight for racial justice. Interestingly, another important person in entertainment, certainly in entertainment in the black community, I don't know. I don't often hear him opine on these topics, but Tyler Perry, the movie mogul, Madea and all that stuff. I don't know. I don't really understand Tyler Perry's career either, I'll be honest with you. Tyler Perry was on with Anderson Cooper talking about these issues. And he's a bit of a self-indulgent guy. But he did have an interesting comment, I think, that surprised Tucker. Surprised Anderson. I could almost see the eyebrows raised behind his black horn rim glasses there. Tyler Perry talking about the defund police movement and trying to provide sort of a leavened analysis of what defund police really means, so giving them some latitude. But his position on defunding the police, in other words, actually reducing their budgets, if not eliminating them altogether, a little different than you might anticipate. He certainly wasn't comparing all police officers in 2020 America to Bull Connor.
Well, when I first heard it, I was troubled by it. I thought, okay, this is going to be weaponized by in this political year. I completely thought that was happening. And that's exactly what's happened. It's been weaponized. But I did some research, and what I would challenge people to do is to do research on find out what it means. Now, you got to understand this. I'm not for taking money for the police department. I think we need more police.
Huh?
My studio is in a neighborhood where I think we need police, but we don't need a police that have or that are undertrained. And you got to understand, I have really close friends who are police officers that I love dearly, who are really good people, who have been very, very hurt by this as well. And here's what I want you to understand, Anderson. Wrong, where there's wrong, I'm going to stand up against it. When Rashad Brooks was murdered, I thought that was wrong. When George Floyd was murdered, I thought that was wrong, like so many other people. But when a police officer who was white in a suburb in Atlanta was shot in the head by a shoplifter, I thought that was wrong too, and I reached out to do what I can to help his family. When Sikoria was 8-year-old was shot near the Wendy's in her mother's backseat, I thought that was wrong too. So anywhere there's wrong, I'm going to stand up against it. I just don't believe that, and I believe that I don't believe that there are lots of people. Let me just change that to understand that there are a lot of people in America who feel the way that I do, right? I think we need the police. I know that I need the police. I have several that work for me here at the studio. We need them, but we need them reformed. We need them trained well. We need the right structure.
Well, okay. At least we have a starting point upon which we can build something. We need the police, right? Because when you remove the police or effectively remove them, not allow them to do their jobs, you see what happens. Cities are on fire. People are victimized by violent predators, including police, by the way. So we need the police, Tyler Perry, but all the police are Bull Connor, Barack Obama. Golly, who's closer to the truth? So at least with Tyler Perry, you can have an intelligent conversation. We need the police. He employs police. He needs them at the studio. He wants them at the studio. And he wants to see reforms. Okay, well, now we can argue about reforms, and that's fine. But that's not the position of the Democrat Socialist Party. And it's not the position that Joe Biden is indulging as presidential candidate. Joe Biden, you'll remember, Obama's former vice president, former vice president under Barack Obama, I should say. I know Biden was just an errand boy for Obama. I understand that. But for those who think that unity is right around the corner, a kinder, gentler America, to borrow another hackish line from another hackish politician, that would be H.W. Bush, of course. Right around the corner, if you just get rid of Trump, he's just so divisive and he's so abrasive. We need a unifier like George W. Bush. We need a uniter like a Barack Obama. Well, if you think that's where the country was under those two presidents, then you just don't remember history properly. And you also don't remember, don't appreciate what the Trump election was an expression of by, you know, 60 million Americans whose opinions count too. We can dance, everything's out of control. We can dance, they're doing it from pole to pole. We can dance, everybody look at your hands. We can dance.
Listen
we can
to the podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the program. Moving from President Obama's demagoguery to the constitutional crisis President Trump's demagoguery has triggered, at least if you believe some of the press accounts of his tweet that we discussed yesterday, knowing that the inartful and provocative nature would generate the response that it generated, although I wasn't expecting it from some quarters, which I'll get to in a second. But again, Trump suggesting, questioning about a universal vote-by-mail election, saying it will be the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history if we go that way. A great embarrassment to the USA. Delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote? And you expect the responses. He can't do that. Yeah, I know. That's why he put question marks there. Should we do that? It sort of indicates that. Is it, again, the most forthright way to deal with it rather than just saying, as the president of the United States, you'll get the attention. You don't need to be too cute by half with it. You'll get the attention if you just say, look at what happened in Paterson, New Jersey. Look at what happened in New York State, just both in the last 2 months. Look at this report that was done by CBS affiliate, a little experiment in mail-in voting in Philadelphia, and other commentary on the topic. And these concerns should be addressed before states, much less the federal government, push this everybody vote by mail paradigm for the 2020 election. You would have got attention that way, too. You would have started the conversation in a way that would have prevented op-eds from the likes of Stephen Calabresi, who's a co-founder of the Federalist Society, the rarest of all things, a conservative law professor at Northwestern University. He writes in the New York Times in response to the tweet, I have voted Republican in every presidential election since 1980, including voting for Donald Trump in 2016. I wrote op-eds in a law reviewed article protesting what I believe was an unconstitutional investigation by Robert Mueller. I also wrote an op-ed opposing President Trump's impeachment. But I'm frankly appalled by the president's recent tweet seeking to postpone the November election. Not exactly. Until recently, I had taken as political hyperbole the Democrats' assertion that President Trump is a fascist. But this latest tweet is fascistic and is itself grounds for the president's immediate impeachment again by the House of Representatives and his removal from office by the Senate. Okay. Stephen Calabresi is a thoughtful guy. He's a solid law professor, co-founder of the Federalist Society. He's, you know, reacting. His reaction is over the top. There's nothing fascistic about this. President Trump, you know, walked it back in at his briefing later in the day yesterday. And there's no disagreement that he cannot do this by executive fiat, that if it were to happen, it would happen at the move of Congress. And that's not going to happen. President Trump also saying he doesn't want it to happen. What he wants to do is have a recognition and a discussion about some of these concerns that he's raised and I raised, and I only wish he would raise them the way I raised them.
So we're asking for a lot of trouble, and no, do I want to see a date change? No, but I don't want to see a crooked election. This election will be the most rigged election in history if that happens.
Yeah, he went on to add this about what he thought the impact of his tweet would be versus what it turned out to be.
Well, it's had an interesting impact. I didn't know it was going to be the impact it had. What people are now looking at is, am I right? But not me. Are all these stories right about the fact that these elections will be fraudulent? They'll be fixed. They'll be rigged. And everyone's looking at it. And a lot of people are saying, you know, that probably will happen. Please.
Right. He didn't know it would set off the firestorm that it set off. Come now, President Trump. He knew. And again, he is a great provocateur, but I don't know that it's necessarily to his benefit. As the Wall Street Journal opined, Mr. Trump's opponents, from the media to Joe Biden, have planted the thought that he won't accept the results of the election or would try to put off the vote. How he helps himself by keeping such disruption narratives in the public's mind remains a mystery. I agree with that. It's unhelpful. It takes you nowhere. You want people to have some confidence in the election so they don't think it's rigged. They think when they go to vote to reelect you, that their vote will count and you will get reelected. And it's not much of a GOTV program to say, don't bother, the thing is rigged. You know what I mean? Again, I'm not taking the position of Professor Calabresi, but there's just another way to do this that is more effective and focuses the discussion productively around the legitimate concerns that we have seen play out in New York and New Jersey, for example. And I played this yesterday, but it bears another playing. Feel free to share it amongst your friends, as well as the reporting on Paterson, New Jersey, and New York, which is on point. This is this experiment that was done in Philadelphia.
We decided to test it, sending 100 mock ballots, simulating 100 voters from locations all across Philadelphia to a P.O. box we set up to represent a local election office. A couple days later, we mailed 100 more, using the same size envelopes and the same class of mail as real ballots here. To approximate the weight, we even folded mock votes into every one. In the following week, we checked our P.O. box for the results.
Mail pickup notice, there's more.
When we went to collect everything, though,
nothing?
Most of our votes seemed to be lost.
That's all I have back there right now.
You're sure, huh? You're totally sure. I believe you on this.
All right, good. Have a good day.
Okay, take care.
We had to ask for a manager.
We're trying to do something about mailing ballots.
And explain ourselves before someone finally found our votes.
We have you somewhere else.
Okay, thank you.
One, two.
We soon discovered another problem, missorted mail. Two pieces of it.
We got a birthday card from Mike to Ronnie. Have a sweet B-day. Get it? There's a B on top.
When the birthday greetings ended,
12, 13,
we found a bigger issue. 21% of our votes hadn't materialized after 4 days. And the batch we'd mailed a week prior, some of those were missing too.
So of our 100 ballots, 97 arrived, which sounds pretty good, unless you consider the fact that that means three people who tried to vote by mail in our mock election were in fact disenfranchised by mail.
In a close election, 3% could be pivotal, especially in what's expected to be a record year for mail-in voting.
We're going to see somewhere between probably 80 and 100 million voters receiving their ballot that way.
The Postal Service says voters should mail their return ballots at least 1 week prior to the due date. But nearly half of all states still allow voters to request ballots less than a week before the election.
Yeah, so it's a complicated matter with elections being administered as state and local affairs and the rules being different state by state, to the reporter's point. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean the 3% error rate or omission rate will be scaled nationally across 100 million ballots, but it certainly does raise some concerns. And maybe then the remedy is just all Trump voters go vote at the ballot box and Democrats, you go back and advocate for your all mail-in election and hope that the percentage of the Democrat votes that are cast not being counted is not more than 3%. How does that sound? As I said, this is something that is being perceived as and reported as just a Republican concern, and it could end up being having Democrats hoist by their own petard.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. We mentioned it yesterday, and we'll get to the testimony from Dr. Fauci and Dr. Redfield a little bit later, but Tony Fauci saying that, you know, it's just a mask. Now it's just a mask, plus it's just eye protection. It's inevitable we're going to get some degree of the flu. I'm hoping that the wearing of masks and other coverings are going to not only protect us against COVID-19, but also help protect us against influenza. He is suggesting that Americans should consider, we're just at the consideration stage, wearing goggles or a face shield in order to prevent spreading or catching COVID-19. But then he went on to say, help protect us against influenza as well. So are masks and face shields and I don't know what's next, the Naked Gun style body condoms, sleeping in hyperbaric chambers, that going to be the new protocol for year-round living as one season melds into the other, COVID and flu? For more on the sense of this, particularly against the backdrop of Western Europe doing something completely different. For example, the Dutch government this week advising the public there will be no mask mandate. The Minister for Medical Care, Tamara Van Ark, made the decision after review by the country's National Institute for Health. There's little evidence, so we're not going to impose mandates based on no evidence in the service not of science, but of fear-mongering. So they're not. By the way, the Dutch kids are back in school, too. For more on all this, no more digressions. Pleased to be joined again by Dr. Joseph Ladapo. He's an associate professor at UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine. Dr. Ladapo, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So from masks to goggles/face shields to whatever is next. And here again, I thought that Tony Fauci, who said people should not be walking around with masks just a couple of months ago on 60 Minutes, I thought they told us at the outset that flatten the curve. You cannot defeat the virus sans a vaccine. So it's about managing the outbreak consistent with our healthcare infrastructure. Now we're pretending that masks and goggles are going to defeat the virus. That's what I'm hearing.
Right. So I just want to say that I'm speaking for myself and not on behalf of UCLA. The way I think about it is that there's health and there's public health / public policy. And right now, the topic of interest in health happens to be COVID-19. So these policy proposals are, if that's the most important thing to do is to reduce morbidity from COVID-19, you know, forget everything else. If that's the most important thing, yeah, there's a reasonable argument. It's not a perfect argument because there's evidence against it, but there's a reasonable argument for masks and for face shields. But again, there are many other things, unfortunately, that kill Americans: heart disease, cancer, strokes. And just as, you know, we can make recommendations for COVID-19, we can make recommendations for these issues too. And from my perspective, it seems like some of those issues are more issues when we're talking about public health and public policy that are better resolved in a legislative process.
Here's the problem. The problem is that the politicians use the health experts for political cover, and then the health experts use the politicians for political cover. And so nobody's ever accountable for being wrong or for advancing junk science or ascientific recommendations, like so much of the mask wearing has been. And now the goggles and what we know and what we don't know, very different today than it was 2 and 3 months ago. OK, fine. But, I don't know how you separate them, because forget the other causes of death, even within COVID-19, in terms of this understanding, the focus should be on masks and goggles. That's what we should be focused on. Or should we be focused on a layered approach that makes sense based on what we learned from the first 3 months of this affliction when it comes to protecting the particularly vulnerable, when it comes to what we know about containing the spread, what environments are more important than others, nursing homes versus schools, two very different environments, and offering a textured approach that is based on what we've experienced as well as based on any new research that has been peer-reviewed and found to be credible.
Yeah, I'm a physician, but I also have a background in economics. And one of the things I learned at the Kennedy School of Government was to think about trade-offs and what the value of different decisions is, what the value of different decisions
is. Yeah, opportunity cost.
When you're approaching a problem, you know, in this case, it's a public policy slash public health problem. It's very sensible. Of course, what you're saying is correct. Like, you know, why would you focus on in one area if there are other areas that could achieve improved outcomes, you know, where you could do better and probably with less cost.
Well, when we get back, when we come back, I should say, with Dr. Ladapo, I want to talk about a couple of things. One, schooling, as I alluded to before. And secondly, this white coat summit that is in so much controversy that Dr. Ladapo attended. More with Dr. Joseph Ladapo, associate professor at UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine, right after this.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the program. We're speaking with Dr. Joseph Ladapo, associate professor at UCLA's David Geffen, I should say, School of Medicine. And Dr. Ladapo, this white coat summit with President Trump defending the doctors who had their video advocating for hydroxychloroquine censored by social media platforms after it went viral. You were at this white coat summit. So are you a crackpot, and were you with a bunch of crackpots, or was this a legitimate event with productive discussion that people should see and consider?
Yeah, I was there, and I will tell you that the other physicians there that I spoke with and got to know and have gotten to know over the past few weeks, they're not there for their self-advancement, which is very common in medicine and policy, right? People who are looking to advance their own careers, they weren't there to sell something, you know, something also very common in this world, right? We know people like to make money, and that influences people's decisions. They were there because they cared passionately and deeply about the well-being of other people. And that's part of the reason it went viral. It's part of the reason that I've been really supportive of them. And the other part is also something that's really important to know. And it doesn't have really anything to do with the doctors there. It has to do with the American people. The video went incredibly viral. And it's not an act, and it's because there are many Americans out there who ultimately have some impression, are left with an impression that they are not getting the full story. There's no question. And people were just so really hungry and thirsty for information that they felt was authentic and fulfilled that need. And all of those things came together to make it so viral.
And so, I mean, so when you see the reaction it's getting, not only the censorship by non-medical professionals, the minders at Google and other platforms, plus some of the commentary that, you know, these were not serious people or these are people that shouldn't be heard from. How do you react?
That's a good question. Well, I guess it's how do I feel and how do I react? So I get where they are coming from in terms of censoring. You know, I think they would argue that, you know, the CDC is saying this and some of these doctors were not saying the same thing. So, you know, this is misinformation. But I think that
Has the CDC been right about everything? I don't think so. I mean, you know, is CDC is the end all be all? Nobody else can speak except the CDC and the medical community. I mean, that's positively Soviet.
Exactly, Dan. And that's where I was going. And I don't fault the CDC. You know, I'm sure the people there are doing the very best that they can. But what you don't need expertise in COVID to know or expertise in the methods of the CDC to know is that if you have doctors who, you know, they're board certified, they take care of patients. Like, these are, if you have doctors who have an opinion, you should be, it is, the world is upside down when you feel a need to actively censor their opinions. That's lunacy. It's completely, you can't wrap your, how does that, how, that there's, I can't think of one good reason for that belief.
Well, and that, and what that does is goes right back to this op-ed you wrote in the Journal the beginning of this month, talking about how public health professionals are undermining their own credibility and the credibility of their colleagues, and the credibility of their colleagues who aren't doing anything. They're just sort of suffering collateral damage, but by behaving this way. You know, if you are so confident in your position, then you should be willing to take on all comers and present your case to the public for public consumption. This you know, whether it's in the medical discipline or anywhere else. And now that this culture that we have is permeating science and the medical fields, boy, that's doubly dangerous because of the importance of the decisions that are rooted in science and medicine.
Absolutely, and Dan, what you're saying, it really is like common basic sense. There's nothing profound there. It's which is not a, you know, no attack on you.
No, I know. I don't take it. I mean, it's amazing that we have to go back and forth with these sorts of statements in 2020 America. Like we're at the cusp of the Enlightenment rather than, you know, a few centuries removed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's crazy that we're even having this conversation. But it demonstrates really just how far deep into the woods we've gone now with like public thought and public policy. That's what it.
Before we let you go, Dr. LaDapa, I wanted to just get your quick take on, you know, all of the experience in the Western world that where schools have reopened, the studies that have been done, the pediatricians that have weighed in on the topic. Is there any reason that even Bill Gates now coming around on the topic, is there any reason that kids should not be back in school to be educated in a school setting, physically present?
Sure. Well, I think, yes, there are reasons why children should not be back physically in school.
If they're otherwise healthy.
But there are way more compelling reasons why they should be mm-hmm. back in school. And that is also a very strong truth. And there are certainly, you know, in terms of the reasons why they shouldn't be back, you know, we hear the main thing, of course, that we hear are concerns about transmission to teachers, transmission to parents, transmission to other vulnerable adults. And then just generally transmission as something that is to be avoided. The very last one, transmission is something to be avoided, is something that is not part of the debate because, you know, there are just some things that are essential and we recognize that, so we do the best we can. Like grocery stores, I mean, schools are at least as important as grocery stores. But in terms of transmission to parents and you know, vulnerable adults, that's obviously a very reasonable concern, but there are steps that we can take to mitigate that. We're not really having that conversation, but we can do something about it. And the reasons to have kids in school are just so much more compelling that's where we should be.
He is Dr. Joseph LaDapa, associate professor at UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine. Dr. LaDapa, thanks again for joining us. Always appreciate it. Take care.
Take care.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Mm-hmm. welcome back. I just want to pick up on the discussion we just completed with Dr. Ladapo from UCLA Medical School, particularly focused on schooling. Tens of millions of families, their quality of life, managing professional plus the kids' education. This is all in flux. This couldn't be more important, not to mention the social and intellectual development of kids. Could not be more important. So this piece at Real Clear Politics that is a good resource for documenting some of the data, since these folks who are lockdown Lucy's traffic in using the words science and data, but not actually following the science and data. Big difference. The CDC has recorded a total of 20 COVID-19 deaths in children ages 5 to 14. That's compared to almost 2,000 deaths from non-COVID causes in the same time period for the same age group. 20 versus 2,000. It means children have been 100 times more likely to die from non-COVID-19 causes during the pandemic than from COVID, which puts the risk of COVID death for children 5 to 14 in the same ballpark as deaths by lightning. And as we've talked about, also, it puts the children in those age groups in a better position in terms of concern about lethal illness than influenza. In other words, there are more healthy children that die from influenza by a significant factor than from COVID-19. Okay, so that's one aspect. And you're likely to get a lot of agreement. Yeah, children, thankfully, it doesn't impact children the same way it impacts adults, and particularly those that are older with comorbidities. You're likely to get that concession. But the real play here is, what about the adults? I want to teach, but I don't want to die. I want to teach, but I also want to live. And it's not about the kids. It's about the kids transmitting to the adult and the adult taking it home to the family and so on and so forth. Okay. Study in Switzerland, including a review by the World Health Organization contact tracing program, failed to find evidence of a single case of a child passing coronavirus to an adult. A comprehensive study in Iceland isolated COVID-19 samples from every positive case, sequenced the virus genome, and tracked the mutation patterns. The study concluded, quoting, "Even if children do get infected, they are less likely to transmit the disease to others than adults. We have not found a single instance of a child infecting parents." A study of schools in Ireland found no evidence of secondary transmission of COVID-19 from children attending school. New Zealand conducted a study across 15 schools in which 18 individuals with COVID-19 infected were in close contact with 735 other students and 128 staff members, yet no teacher, no staff member contacted COVID-19 from any of the initial 18, and only two of the other students out of the total of 735 would later test positive. The New Zealand study concluding, "Our investigation found no evidence of children infecting teachers." So again, make the case for keeping the schools closed, knowing the equally strong evidence of how ineffectual the remote learning is, how much it retards a child's intellectual and social development, and jeopardizes it, their mental health as compared to as compared to being in school and risking the infinitesimal chance of exposure, infection, transmission.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us at danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes. Twitter, at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. The exchanges between Attorney General Barr and House Judiciary Committee Democrat Socialists this week couldn't have been more instructive in terms of understanding which side thinks the police and federal law enforcement are the problem associated with the rioting and violence in America's big cities, and which side thinks that it's the people committing acts of violence that are the problem. And one of the exchanges before they got into that wonderful discussion about whether Attorney General Barr would be allowed a 5-minute bathroom break, when they were actually talking about substantive things, was Nadler's concern about the deployment of federal law enforcement and Barr's concern about things like, oh, I don't know, a courthouse in Portland being burned down.
protecting federal property, and specifically U.S. courthouses, which are the heart of federal property in all 93 jurisdictions in the United States. And we have the obligation to protect federal courts, and the U.S. Marshals specifically have been given that obligation. Federal courts are under attack. Since when is it okay to try to burn down a federal court? If someone went down the street to the Prettyman Court here, that beautiful courthouse we have right at the bottom of the hill, and started breaking windows and firing industrial-grade fireworks in to start a fire, throw kerosene balloons in and start fires in the court, is that okay? Is that okay now? No, the U.S. Marshals have a duty to stop that and defend the courthouse, and that's what we are doing in Portland. We are at the courthouse defending the courthouse. We're not out looking for trouble.
Meanwhile, in Portland, according to Andy Ngo, reporter who's local, according to a law enforcement source he tweeted, there have been 22 homicides in Portland since the 1st of June. In all of 2019, there were 36. Last month, the mayor there, Ted Wheeler, dismantled the gun violence reduction team because he and others said it was unfair to blacks. 22 homicides in the last 60 days in Portland after 36 in all of 2019. But those big city mayors who were all experiencing a spike in violent crime, including in Chicago, they all have it under control. They've got the problem identified, federal law enforcement. Meanwhile, the left can't even decide to work in conjunction with one another, even the professional agitators, as a wall of moms and Black Lives Matter are now sparring over identity politics of all things.
I'm a single mom and I work full time and I have to come and spend my nights with you.
I got to tell you, that woman is indistinguishable from most of the members of the House Judiciary Committee, most of the Democrat Socialist members. She sounded exactly like Representative Jayapal, as far as I could tell. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Ken Cuccinelli. He is the Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security. Deputy Secretary Cuccinelli, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. We'll try and keep the screaming to a minimum here. Yes. Yeah, I'm sure you appreciate that. With respect to Attorney General Barr's testimony, to the extent he was allowed to testify at that House Judiciary Committee hearing, I thought he laid it out pretty simply that federal law enforcement is there to protect federal property. The Constitution is very clear on the topic of the chief executive of the federal government enforcing federal law. So it's a bit confusing as to exactly the concerns of the Democrat Socialists.
Yeah, certainly people should know that, frankly, most House hearings go like that. You saw more press on this one because it was the Attorney General, who, by the way, is particularly good at pointing that out, as you also observed. But most House hearings are basically, they each get 5 minutes, and that means their time and the answer to their questions, and they basically just yell at you and lie at you. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the 5 minutes, they have this phrase, I take back my time.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm convinced they've come up with this phrase because it means nothing by itself. Because what they're saying is you don't get to answer, you don't get to talk, but they don't want to be on camera saying that. So they have cooked up this phrase, I take back my time, to literally keep those of us who show up to provide insight, truth, and from talking. And the Attorney General, I think, made that pretty clear over the course of his, quote, hearing, unquote.
Tell me about these Shining Path death squads that you're operating that are pulling people off the streets in unmarked vehicles to take them away to black sites for, I assume, torture, that I've understood from the characterization of some members of Congress.
Yeah, the members of Congress who actually know what's happening and yet come say something else when these are their federal officers who they've directed to be there. You're referring to the controversy around the video about two CBP agents detaining an individual and departing the area in an unmarked van. But what you don't see before that video begins is the 1 or 2 block foot chase after the two officers had identified themselves to the individual as federal agents. And then he took off running. They identified themselves to him is because it was believed may have matched the description of someone who had assaulted two federal officers only an hour before. So he took off running. They ran after him, eventually stopped running at the courthouse. that's where the video begins, where they calmly detain him. And you can kind of hear in the background the noise, and you can get a sense of the dangerous situation. So that's why they got in the van. They drove a short distance away. They had a conversation determining that he was not, affirmatively, that he was not the person that we were looking for the assaults, and was released. And all that took place in under 10 minutes. The uniforms identify who they are. They verbally identified who they are. Every law enforcement organization in America uses undercover vehicles, and particularly with these riots, you have noticed how marked police vehicles have been targets for explosives and burning down, including with officers in them. So the use of unmarked vehicles is just a safety feature that allows us to do our job correctly.
Do you feel like you've been vindicated somewhat by this agreement between the federal government and the state of Oregon, Governor Kate Brown there, that she will send the state police in as a backstop to local law enforcement? And while those federal law enforcement officials that are on the ground will stay as a backstop to the backstop, she's essentially conceded the point that what's happening in Portland is not being addressed by the local officials. So she will send in the state police. It seems to me that says something about the work that the federal law enforcement officials were doing and the reason they were doing it.
Yeah, there's no question. And the conversations this week were productive, as you can see. And last night in the I told you so category, that with joint policing that started early in the day, there was no violence last night. So what we've been saying all along was vindicated last night. We appreciate the governor finally advancing the Oregon State Police. It's too bad she had to, because Portland wouldn't allow their police to actually police. That's going in the right direction. We'll see how this weekend goes. But this is exactly the kind of cooperation that we have in the rest of the country.
So there hasn't been any other, yes, the public posturing, I get. But in terms of the working relationship that you're describing, not Jenny Durkin in Seattle, not de Blasio in New York, not Lightfoot in Chicago. Everywhere else you're getting cooperation and you're able to operate freely with local law enforcement?
Yeah, we have our issues. For instance, with New York, their statutory bar of information for our immigration enforcement. That's one issue. But when it comes to just straight up violence, whether it's from gangs where DHS has some of the most important expertise in the country, or drug enforcement with DEA, et cetera, there's broad scale cooperation.
What about for the DNC next month in Milwaukee, with all the local law enforcement agencies pulling out of participating in the security because of the protocol that the Milwaukee City Council has put in place regarding dealing with crowds that could become violent?
Yeah, that'll be interesting to watch. Having been to a number of conventions, you know, that police presence is important. It really is. I don't think you can really pull off a convention without an active police engagement because of the attraction of protesters that happens. And it's both parties. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just, it's a point where demonstrators know they can get their attention.
Right.
But with the path of demonstrations this year and so much acceptance by the left of violence in the, you know, right alongside traditional and protected protesting, that makes for a very difficult and dangerous situation. And frankly, you know, there's a little bit of reaping what you sow going on there. We want peace, and we want everybody, regardless of how crazy their views might be, to be able to express those views peacefully. But when it crosses the line into violence or threats of violence, that's where law enforcement does need to step in. That's what DHS has been doing in Portland and other places in the country.
But there's no plans for Milwaukee for the DNC at this point.
Well, it's a major national event, and we will have some of our own security there for protection. But in terms of the local effort and state and local effort, that remains to be seen.
He is Ken Cuccinelli, Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security. Deputy Secretary Cuccinelli, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Listen to podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the show. American coaches at three NBA training academies in China told officials their Chinese partners were physically abusing young players and failing to provide schooling, even though NBA Commissioner Adam Silver has said that education would be central to the program. This according to multiple sources reported by left-wing outlet ESPN, or MSESPN, as Clay Travis calls it this week. The NBA ran into myriad problems by opening one of the academies in Xinjiang, a police state in western China, where more than a million Uyghur Muslims are now held in barbed wire camps, concentration camps. American coaches frequently harassed and surveilled there. One American coach detained three times without cause, I should say. He and others were unable to obtain housing because of their status as foreigners. Former league employee comparing the atmosphere in Xinjiang to World War II Germany. In an interview with ESPN about the findings, the deputy commissioner of the NBA and chief operating officer Mark Tatum said the NBA is reevaluating considering other opportunities for the academy program, which operates out of sports facilities run by the Chinese government. We were somewhat humbled, Tatum told ESPN. One of the lessons we learned here is that we do need to have more direct oversight and the ability to make staffing changes when appropriate. Yeah, who would have thunk it? Who could have seen that coming? Boy, Daryl Morey tweet heard around the world from a few months back sure isn't aging well in terms of those who ridiculed him, criticized him for daring to cross their Chinese overlords in support of Chinese communist overlords, I should be specific, in support of Hong Kongans yearning for freedom from those same Chinese communist overlords. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined again by Stephen Mosher. He's the president of the Population Research Institute, an expert on China, and an author of Bully of Asia, Why China's Dream is the New Threat to World Order. Stephen Mosher, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's good to be here with you.
How about the NBA, arguably, according to them, being mugged by the reality of Chinese communism?
Well, they shouldn't be surprised. Look, the Chinese training, Olympic training camps, sports training camps are really brutal schools where the kids aren't educated at all. They're forced to do whatever sport they're supposed to be training in all day long. It's like a concentration camp. Kids that don't perform are smacked, they're hit. Kids that get injured are simply sent home, sometimes in wheelchairs. A lot of the gymnasts in China, you know, they start with 100 young kids at 3 years of age. You see on your screen when the Olympics take place, the one survivor, and there are dozens of others who've been injured and simply sent home and maybe crippled for the rest of their life because they fell off a balance beam and broke their hip. The Chinese government doesn't care. The Chinese Communist Party does not care about human beings. They are simply disposable. They use them, and if they break, they simply throw them away. Now, I'm surprised that the NBA, it took the NBA so long to learn this. Their coaches have probably been reporting this for years.
Absolutely.
That's just the way things are in China, and they've covered it up from the beginning.
Well, right, exactly. The question is who the they is. Yes, we know, of course, the Chinese communists aren't going to advertise this, but what the NBA knew or didn't know and what it did about what it knew, that's what's where it starts to get interesting. They're getting at this ESPN story. The NBA brought in elite coaches and trainers with experience in the developmental league as well as D1. And one former coach described watching a Chinese coach fire a ball into a young player's face at point blank range and kick him in the gut, saying, imagine you have a kid who's 13, 14 years old, and you got a grown coach who's 40 years old hitting your kid. We're a part of that. The NBA is a part of that. That's what's going on. And the NBA, I suspect, was just looking at the bottom line and not looking at the abuse of these kids.
Yeah, look, the NBA concerns about profits in China. That's all they're concerned about. They don't want to lose the China market. They know that the Chinese Communist Party will prevent any NBA game from ever airing in China ever again if they cross the Chinese Communist Party. No jerseys will ever be sold again in Chinese shoes. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party plays for keeps. But I guarantee that these coaches who are working in this NBA program knew from day one that they weren't walking into a normal training camp. They were walking into, I don't know, a kind of school for gladiators, but I think the Roman gladiators were treated better than the athletes in China. There are teams that go around to Chinese towns and villages and look at kids when they're 3 and 4 and 5 years old and decide whether they can do gymnastics or whether they're tall and they can do basketball and so forth. They're not given any schooling. They're simply in training camps from the time they're very small children. And once they break, as I say, they're thrown away and they can't read and write. They have no other skills. They've learned to do a layup. They've learned to do a dunk if they're that tall. And if they can't do a layup in the dunk, they're useless to the Chinese state. We shouldn't be even competing in the Olympics against China because those athletes are all professional athletes who've been trained from the age of 3 years old. And as I say, they're the survivors.
Yeah, I mean, this is not like some stylized, Rocky IV Chinese communist version, no. As I think some people were were trying to make believe it was. You wrote a piece as well, New York Post recently, about Nike Nike in the same position of rank hypocrite as the NBA.
Oh, yeah. Nike is a really woke company, isn't it? I mean, Nike is constantly hectoring America, the United States, on our supposed failings. And we're not perfect, of course, but they're in China, and they're in China in a very big way. Their factories where they manufacture those famous shoes with the swoosh on them are employing slave labor from the western part of China, what we call Xinjiang. There are now in China, in western Turkestan, over 1 million Uyghur men in concentration camps. And the young people, if they're not in concentration camps, they're being sold in batches of 100. You can't order 99 or 101. You have to order a batch of 100. And they come to your factory, and they diligently work for 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week. Under guard, they can't leave the factory compound. And they're making, in one factory in Qingdao, northern China, they're making Nike shoes. So you can't have a company that, on the one hand, tells us that they're working against discrimination in communities worldwide, which is what Nike says, and on the other hand, they're using slave labor in China to manufacture their products.
So while we're relitigating the era of slavery in this country, Nike is engaged in slavery in China.
Yeah, I mean, nothing says systemic racism like genocide, which is what the Chinese Communist Party is doing to these poor Uyghurs who are slaving away, in some cases, making Nike shoes. The men are in concentration camps. There is a big program to abort and sterilize any Uyghur woman who has more than two children. And as I say, the young people are being sold at batches of 100. There are advertisements on the Chinese internet for Chinese factory owners to order them in batches of 100. The Chinese factory workers, owners don't need to worry about security, however, because the Uyghur young people come with their own police detachment. Isn't that convenient? They have their own police detachment to watch over them and make sure they stay at their sewing machine working all day long. And as an added bonus, the Uyghur young people in the evening, who are 1,000 miles away from their home and families, get to sit through 2 or 3 hours of propaganda lessons, learning the sayings of the new Red Emperor Xi Jinping, learning to speak fluent Han Chinese. Many of them would like to go back to their native place, but they will wind up being married. The young women will wind up being married to Chinese men. And this is a program, as I say, of slow-rolling genocide. They're not herding these people into gas chambers, but what they're doing is they're putting them in factories and concentration camps, preventing them from having children. And the end result is that the Uyghurs will be eliminated as a people from the face of the earth in a generation or two. And this is quite deliberate. It is slow-rolling genocide, but it is genocide that's making a profit, because all the while the Chinese companies, the Chinese state, the Chinese Communist Party officials are making a profit from the slave labor of the Uyghurs as they gradually eliminate them from the face of the earth. You can't make this stuff up.
Stephen Mosier, president of the Population Research Institute, China, Communist China expert and author of Bully of Asia, Why China's Dream is the New Threat to World Order. Stephen Mosier, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show, and Kimberly L's book, The Invincible Family, couldn't be more timely against the backdrop of a sex trafficking trial that is likely to unfold involving Ghislaine Maxwell and the whole Jeffrey Epstein criminal enterprise, as well as the removal, the continued removal, erosion of authority of parents over their own children, mostly by teachers' unions and administrators that you see playing out in schools that won't reopen, regardless of the popular view of the parents, regardless of the science. Parents aren't in control, and government is. Government is growing at the expense of the private family. And that growth may not be limited to the boundaries of the United States. That's the main thrust of Kimberly L's excellent book. Again, it's The Invincible Family, Why the Global Campaign to Crush Motherhood and Fatherhood Can't Win. She is a policy advisor for Family Watch International, and she joins us now. Kimberly, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
In a recent piece in Town Hall, you picked up on something that most people missed. In fact, I did, too, until I read your piece, which is the appeal of the George Floyd family attorney, Ben Crump, to the UN for help in obtaining justice for George Floyd. Explain the play there.
Yeah, it was very interesting. So the Floyd family lawyer appealed to the United Nations, as you said, to intervene in this issue and to even invite them to intervene in basically our police system and our law enforcement system in the United States. And that's pretty unprecedented. Obviously, the UN and major international bodies are sometimes called upon to intervene in war-torn countries or things like that. But what they claimed was that the United States has systemically deprived black people of their human right to life for decades, and therefore a higher power, in a sense, needed to be called in. And that's problematic because it suggests that, you know, our own government is incompetent for dealing with our own issues. It frames the United Nations as a more legitimate governing body than our own United States of America. And it invites, like I said, it invites the United Nations to intervene basically in our law enforcement dealings and to weigh in on that. And that's just a very dangerous path to open up, especially when there's so much turmoil and it calls for our own police force to be weakened or you know, defunded or disbanded altogether. It paves the way for international involvement, which may not be what we want.
Well, right. And obviously that's not going to happen under President Trump. Whatever Minneapolis does or doesn't want, that's not going to fly. But under a different president, perhaps there would be more a hospitable environment for such a call. Also, as you were sort of pointing out, it demands the left sort of reconcile their position. At the same time, you're defunding and reimagining the police in Minneapolis. You want blue berets coming in from Brussels to patrol the streets in foreign uniforms with armored vehicles. As some sort of peacekeeping force, I'm having difficulty reconciling exactly what their view on law enforcement is.
Right. It's difficult. I think people have just jumped on the bandwagon of defunding the police and haven't looked forward to, okay, what would that actually look like? I mean, there's been some ideas thrown out about having social workers intervene in this and that, and there may be a place for some of that. But the thing is, if we need to look at, okay, so if we do away with our own police forces, you can't just not have law enforcement, because then your laws become unenforceable, and therefore you have a totally chaotic society, and the rule of law cannot stand. And so we need to look really carefully at this and ask ourselves if this is the path that we want to go down. We especially need to look at the actions and policies of the United Nations in past decades and their track record as peacekeeping troops, and ask ourselves, do we want to lay ourselves open to that authority, or are we better off dealing with and accepting and even improving our own police force as it is, which we have control over?
Yeah.
We have control of our own forces. Do we want to cede that to someone else? The answer should be no.
Right. And actually, we talked about it on this show about a month ago. There was a piece in the New York Times about a suburb of Minneapolis inhabited by, sort of 60s refugees that went ahead, called Powderhorn Park, which went ahead and stopped calling the police and moved to eliminate their police. And residents were just going to take it upon themselves to do dispute resolution and so on and so forth. Utter and complete disaster, unmitigated disaster. So, there's a lot of cautionary tales that people can look to. These aren't just academic exercises. When we come back, I'm going to pick up our conversation with Kimberly Ells on parental authority, particularly in the space of education, and exactly what the play is for international agencies or international lawists to insinuate themselves into the governance of the United States, including at the local level. More with Kimberly Ells, policy advisor for Family Watch International, author of The Invincible Family, Why the Global Campaign to Crush Motherhood and Fatherhood Can't Win. We'll be back right after this.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. We're speaking with Kimberly Ells, policy advisor for Family Watch International, author of The Invincible Family. And Kimberly, before the break, we were talking about the Floyd case insofar as his attorney making a call to the UN to enlist their help for justice for George Floyd on American soil. I wanted to tackle another aspect of this, which is schooling. We're seeing all over the country, particularly in big cities, that parents want to send their kids back to school. The evidence, as we spoke about earlier in the show with Dr. Ladapo from UCLA, is overwhelmingly in favor in terms of a cost-benefit analysis of kids being back in school for their social and intellectual development, up against the infinitesimal risk of any serious illness or transmission, for that matter. And yet the teachers' unions are saying no. And they're saying add equity or else. And even Dr. Redfield at CDC this week talked about excess deaths from suicide of high school students that far outnumber deaths from COVID-19. And the teachers' unions are still saying add equity or else. The or else could even be the mental health of children. We want this much money. We want this much staff. We want these policies enacted at the federal and state level, or we're not coming back. We don't care what the science and data says. We don't care what the prevailing view is among the families we're supposed to serve. This the slow but steady usurpation of parental authority by schools seems to me that's one level of government. It perhaps opens the door for a continued usurpation from more levels of government.
It certainly does. And parents are the first line of government. Like, a family is a small little government in and of itself, and that's as it should be. And when it's functioning well, it works well. So, like you said, over the years, that model has eroded, and we've ceded more and more power that resides in the family to other sources. And so you mentioned, you know, the teachers' unions and various groups and organizations are making these specific demands. Well, this has to be done before we can get in school. And these demands that they're making are in line with the global education objectives that the United Nations has for the schools of the world. And this is something that I explore deeply in the book that most people are not aware of, the desire of the UN to insert itself into our school systems here in the United States. And that is already has already happened on a large scale. There's a huge framework, digital framework, and relationships between organizations that have already been established so that the UN can then kind of curate its own curriculum and trickle that in to influence the beliefs of the youth of our country and of the world. And it's all very well documented. And it's stunning to most parents when they realize, oh, I didn't know we were not just ceding our responsibility away to the local school board, but that the local school board may very well be in cahoots with organizations who have ties to the United Nations and their agendas, which are very socialistic and deeply anti-family.
You know, it all sounds very black helicopter-ish right up until you watch, for example, in Chicago, where I am, a contingent of the senior leadership of the Chicago Teachers Union do a fact-finding mission to Caracas, Venezuela, to sing the praises of the dictator there, Nicolas Maduro, and the wonderful education system that Venezuela has. You know, so when you see sort of that sort of international cooperation and you get that very clearly what the attitude is, the Marxist philosophy of the teachers' unions brass and many teachers, not hardly all, but many, particularly in the leadership level, then it starts to sound so conspiratorial. Stops to sound so conspiratorial, I should say.
Yes. And when I first got onto this trail and had some colleagues that I was listening to, I thought, wait a minute, are you sure about this? And so I've done, you know, significant research into these things. And in my book, The Invincible Family, it's all documented. And I decided that I would not put anything in there that I myself had not solidly researched and found. And so if you're curious about education, if you're curious about the direction the world is going, I hope this will be valuable to you. And I want to point out, it was just last week that the UN Secretary General said a new model for global governance is coming. And that should get everyone's ears pricked up. And he said it would be based on redistributing power and wealth, which is socialism. And so part of that, that's a very complicated thing that they've been planning for a very long time. And it's not someone else saying that that's what they're going to do. That's the UN Secretary General declaring that a new model for global governance is coming. So
sure,
we need to pay attention to that.
Sure, you can't have Sweden being an outlier and not locking down their country the way that others in the West and the Western media want these countries locked down. Sweden has been a real thorn in the side of the the Illuminati here, the vanguard class in the Western world, and they need to fall in line. And that's how you get them to fall in line is have them fall under sort of this one world government model. I wanted to get your also comment on something I said at the outset against the backdrop of this Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, sex trafficking, criminal enterprise that went on for at least 25 years. And the push at the international level to sexualize children and the implications of that.
Right. And what many people aren't aware that there is an agenda called the Children's Sexual Rights Agenda. I discovered this myself several years ago. That's how I got into family advocacy to begin with. I found a document published by International Planned Parenthood Federation celebrating and advocating for sexual rights for children. That disturbed me, as it does most people. There's a huge element in the book, The Invincible Family. And so not only is International Planned Parenthood Federation pushing this agenda, but they regularly partner with UN agencies. And so, and I have ample evidence in the book of UN agencies, UNESCO, UNICEF, and so forth, supporting and advocating for the children's sexual rights agenda, presenting sex to kids as if it is simply their human right. So when we see these global moves for greater power, we have to also be keyed into what is their sexual agenda for the youth of the world. And I'm telling you, it's not pretty. Just they promote comprehensive sexuality education programs that, for instance, by age five, they want little children to be instructed on gender incongruence, basically telling kids that what your body is and what your gender is are very often different. And your parents and your doctor told you you were male or female at birth, but now it's your opportunity to really discover what you really are. And they want children to be indoctrinated in that teaching by age five. They encourage masturbation at the earliest ages, yes, the earliest possible ages. There's examples of this. I'm sorry to bring these things up, but yeah, they're a reality.
Yeah.
And then using porn to enhance their sexual life, and of course presenting sex continually as a right for children and for anyone of any age not connected to marriage. In fact, there's a quote from International Planned Parenthood's document that says, sexual pleasure is an important part of being human for everyone, no matter what age, no matter if you're married or not, and no matter if you want to have children or not.
Kimberly Ells, Policy Advisor for Family Watch International, author of The Invincible Family, Why the Global Campaign to Crush Motherhood and Fatherhood Can't Win. Kimberly, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. We spoke of the passing of former presidential candidate and successful business executive Herman Cain yesterday, but want to address it again in a little bit more detail, particularly now that, as expected, you've had leftist politicians and media types like Fredo Cuomo, who are really, in the most vile way possible, reducing a man who lived an incredible life, an accomplished man, to a cheap political talking point because he died from COVID-19 and because there's a picture of him at Trump's Tulsa rally not wearing a mask. It is really sort of the most disgusting, craven, undignified sort of commentary, which is, I know, Fredo Cuomo's calling card.
The virus is rapidly swallowing us. It just took Herman Cain. We wish his family well, and we wish that he rest in peace. And I wish that this president have no peace until he thinks about what he's exposing people to. He didn't even mention that Mr. Cain was at his rally among the maskless masses right before he was diagnosed. Now, maybe he didn't get it there. Sure as hell didn't help.
You know, that's the sort of cheap insinuation that, again, is the stock and trade of ignoramus like Cuomo. Also did not mention what we mentioned on this show, the study that was actually done about Tulsa, despite studies that haven't been done about mass protests and so forth that found no evidence of any spike in transmission as a result of that rally in Tulsa. Also there, as Cuomo said, as we mentioned yesterday, there's no way to know how Herman Cain got it. It's also worth noting, you know, from Mr. Mask as the magic elixir, Cuomo got it too. The magic mask didn't protect him from contracting COVID-19. But I guess the difference for him is he survived because he's not a 74-year-old man with comorbidities, something else conveniently left out of the discussion. Sean Casten is a target. He's a honorary socialist Spice Girl who represents the western suburbs of Chicagoland, a seat formerly held by Henry Hyde and Peter Roskam. That's how far Chicagoland has fallen. I'm truly sorry for Herman Cain's family, and I'm truly sad about Louis Gohmert getting COVID, but I have absolutely no sympathy nor tolerance for people who are willingly not wearing masks that would protect others from the viruses they're carrying. His colleague on the other side of the aisle, Dan Crenshaw from Texas, responding, "This is so gross. Condolences for the death of a human being don't need to come with caveats." Indeed. And a former staffer for Herman Cain, served as his comms director on his presidential bid in 2012, Ellen Carmichael. "I'm very saddened to learn of the passing of my former boss, Herman Cain. I'm bracing for the cruelty online about how he deserved to get COVID and die because of his politics. We're living in a dark time, but they didn't know him. I did. Herman Cain made it worthwhile, the chaos of being part of his campaign," she's referencing. "He was a giant of a person in ways that people who would choose to see him merely as a caricature could never understand. His American dream story is one for the history books, overcame absolute destitution, genuine discrimination, stage four cancer, and so much hardship in between, rose up the ranks of America's biggest corporations, advised presidential campaigns, chaired a Federal Reserve Bank, became a presidential candidate himself. But he was never a victim. He was a happy warrior. He overcame real oppression, and that's what really grinds the gears of these Marxists, whether they're on television or in the halls of power. This is Dan Proft.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. Follow us at danproftshow.com, on social media at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. Yesterday, despite it being wholly anticipated, as the relatively modest market reaction so indicated, the D.C. press corps was a flutter, aghast at the 33% decline in GDP in Q2, annualized. The worst ever recorded, blaring headlines about downturn in the economy. You shut down at least half the economy and you see a substantial decline in GDP. Boy, who would have ever connected those dots? As the Wall Street Journal editorial board opined, the second quarter offers a window on what an economy run by politicians looks like. And yet against this backdrop, you have lockdown loosies all over the country, lockdown loosies of the left, of course, redundant, arguing for a second round of lockdowns. They think a 33% contraction in the second quarter is a business model. Consumer spending fell 35%, accounted for some 25 percentage points of the GDP decline. Healthcare represents about 12% of the U.S. economy. Its collapse subtracted about 10 percentage points from GDP. And according to market analyst Don Luskin, politicians panicked in March, waited for a surge of COVID-19 patients that the pandemic modelers told them would arrive. Blessedly, the modelers were wrong. Far fewer hospital and intensive care beds were needed. But the economic harm from stopping all elective surgeries and barring visits to doctors was severe and not necessary. It was also a terrible public health blunder in addition to an economic one. And what we had is an increase in disposable income thanks to government transfer payments, which are not sustainable. But don't tell that to the halls of power, because both parties advancing phase four relief include another round of transfer payments to Americans. And one other thing that has lost in all of this, the journal reminds us, the virus was always likely to spread through most of the country without a vaccine. That's what the CDC predicted in March. The lockdown is a miracle cure fantasy is something the World Health Organization even now acknowledged in rejecting. The economic and public health harm is too great and the virus too easily transmissible. What no one needs is another catastrophe like the second quarter lockdown. But that doesn't mean we won't get it. And research by the Heritage Foundation, taking a look at countries that did and did not lock down, data from 10 countries, their top line conclusion, full lockdown, such as those implemented in Italy and Norway, not as effective as the more targeted approaches taken in other countries, such as South Korea and Iceland. They also look at two similarly situated countries, population wise, climate wise, neighbors, Australia and New Zealand. find similar outcomes regarding COVID-19, even though the two took very different approaches to the virus, with Australia a much lighter touch than Norway. The only difference is not on the COVID side, the public health side. The difference is on the economic side, where New Zealand has inflicted greater economic harm on itself to no particular effect than Australia has by comparison. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined again by Scott the Cow Guy Shalady, Fox Business regular. Scott, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be here.
And so while the second quarter GDP number wasn't a particular surprise, that doesn't mean it's not still particularly painful and concerning.
Yeah, obviously, I mean, since records began, 1947, I think, was when they last had something similar. And I don't like to see these jobless numbers start to plateau or like flatten out a little bit. We would have liked to see more and more people go back to work. And we'll see what we get next week when we have the unemployment numbers. But you know what? I'm still trying to get over the fact that they think that we have any chance of a V-shaped recovery. I mean, I have no idea what they're thinking about when they're sitting around that table talking about it, because it's just not going to happen.
Well, and the reason you know on the jobless numbers too is you have a number of states going back into you know, previous phases of everybody's phased reopening and so forth. So that can't be a terrible surprise.
Well, I just wrote a piece for this weekend, and basically it's entitled, you know, the stab wound for life. I mean, we're going to deal with, it's going to be the cold, flu, and COVID season for the rest of our entire lives. We have to learn how to live with it, right? Lockdowns are not an answer. You just said that they've been proven not to be effective. And all you do is just prolong the pain, because it's not doing anything unless you get a vaccine and or something that can treat the virus. So we're going to have this with us. We're going to have to get over the fact that the American psyche has been so battered by the media on a daily basis, a number of cases, record surge, record spike. If we flip the switch in every state right now in America and said, look, there's no more coronavirus, we're good to go, 60% of Americans would go out, 40% would not. We can't fill a restaurant or a bar, a stadium or a theater, a bus or a subway. Until we can start to do that, we're not going to come back to life here. So I'm telling you, I think this is a 2022 problem. I mean, I think the American psyche is that battered that this is not going to come back as quickly as folks would like to think. And look, the Fed has even stood there and said, we're here for the duration. It looks like it's going to be longer. We might have to have interest rates at zero until 2024. So I think the more and more people are waking up to the fact that we've got an aircraft carrier of bad news that we've been ignoring. More furloughs, more bankruptcies, more layoffs. And we just conveniently whistle by the graveyard when this stuff is real. And so I think that we've got a significant amount of time on our hands here where we're going to just have to learn to live with it. I mean, we're going to have to get over it.
Well, I've got some good news for you. In the Senate Republican proposal that was unveiled this week, in addition to the next round of transfer payments, in addition to walking away from the payroll tax cut, because as Steve Mnuchin explained to us, that transfer payments even better than a payroll tax cut because it gets in consumers' hands faster. In addition to all of that, the Senate GOP proposal includes $1.75 billion for the design and construction of a new Washington, D.C. headquarters for the FBI. So that's, I mean, that's stimulative.
Yeah, extremely. Maybe for the, you know, the union that gets to build the building, but that's it. So I don't know what to say to these people. We're spending our grandchildren's money, and it's still a psychological problem. And I don't understand why this is so difficult to understand. You can't solve a virus with cash. You could put $1 million in gold bars out at the end of a lot of these people's driveways, and they're too afraid to come out and go get it. That's a problem. So it's a mental issue that they're trying to solve with money, and it's not going to work. So we have to start to prepare the U.S. consumer and the average American citizen to learn to live with this, because it's going to be with us. This is a stab wound. We don't know how deep it is, right? But when we're still finding out how deep it is, it's not a superficial cut. It's deep, and we just still don't know how deep. And again, we, even though we're going to get a vaccine, we got a flu vaccine, but a lot of people still don't take it. Even if we're going to get some things that will help you with the day-to-day malady of the virus, there are people out there that are still so scared. They feel like it's the bubonic plague because the media has set it up to be that way, that this is going to be a big dent in the economy for a while. And at some point in time, and maybe you're already there, but there's at some point in time, lockdown can't be an answer because we can't afford it. So, I mean, I don't know why they think we can, but we're going to get to a point where it's not even a choice. So that's even more of a rallying cry to get used to this virus and learn to live with it.
One thing that's been interesting is
businesses, including big businesses, no longer the bad guy. You hear less demagoguery from politicians of big business, and you also find, according to a new Axios Harris poll, that industries, particularly those with a prominent role in life under quarantine, are enjoying newfound levels of approval. The ranking the top 100 companies based on consumer scores across seven qualities. 75% of consumers agree, generally speaking, that companies were more reliable than the federal government in keeping America running during the shutdown. 81% agree that large companies with resources, infrastructure, advanced logistics, even more vital now to America's future than before the pandemic. So maybe if there is an unintentional benefit to be had from this calamity, it's a renewed love affair with free markets and businesses that grow and can do all sorts of things in a nimble fashion in a way the federal government can't.
Yes, absolutely, 100%. But I also do believe that going into the pandemic, the unemployment numbers were so tight and efficient that these companies knew that they had to continue down those roads of treating those people well, because when and if we come out of it, and we will, and you know, they're going to be struggling to get the good people again. So they have to do what they can do to keep them. And, you know, again, here we go. What's going to happen to these big cities? And we can go on, and that's a whole other show. But you've got, say, Google, I think, that announced this week that they're not going to have those, you know, you can opt out to not come back to the office until July of 2021. And Facebook came out this week as well and said it's indefinite whether you need to come back to the office or not. So we've got a whole sea change of things that are happening. There's going to be some winners and there's some losers. But it's going to be very interesting to see how long this takes, because I definitely think that this is going to take a lot longer than people think. And number two is how bad it's going to be and how long it's going to be. Those are two huge unknowns. And so we can throw that V-shaped recovery, it's getting me angry, out the window.
When we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that V-shaped, U-shaped, trending toward L-shaped recovery and some of the other perhaps long-term changes that may arise from the policy choices we've made in response to the pandemic. More with Scott Shalady, Fox Business contributor, right after this.
Podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking to Scott the Cow Guy Shalady, Fox Business contributor, market analyst, longtime financial services professional, about not just the second quarter GDP number, but a little bit of a look ahead to the third quarter and beyond, including the structural changes that may come out of this, depending on when the majority of the American people come out of this in terms of their fear of reentering all aspects of society, including commercial activity again. And Scott, you were talking a bit at the end about the work environment and remote working. And to tackle this topic a little bit earlier in the week, but let's revisit it, get your perspective. And that is that, you know, what initially looked good may not turn out to be the approach that a lot of companies want to take in the near term, much less the long term. And that's to say, initially, people remote working, we learned that we can do that. We learned that maybe we don't need the same office footprint. But then a lot of CEOs and HR professionals are now saying, well, actually, you know, there's value to this collaboration, and the initial sort of holding the line on productivity or even increasing productivity out of fear of losing your job, that's somewhat subsided. And now C-suite types are starting to complain a little bit about the logistics of trying to work with everybody just via screen and in distance. That they want people back in physical space, particularly, for example, the senior person at the firm mentoring the younger person at the firm, that dynamic as well. And so, you know, the end of the commercial office space may have been greatly exaggerated. I wonder how you think that plays out, both in terms of the work environments as well as then the impact on the commercial real estate sector that was predicted to really be substantially negative and maybe not so substantially.
Well, I mean, I would say that they were having commercial real estate was sucking wind going into it, so they were kind of already, you know, a one-legged man in a fight. So I don't really I think that's going to suffer, obviously, in the short term. This is not going to be 9/11, by the way. We're not going to recover like we did. You know, I remember flying the first day we could fly, and I thought, oh, my gosh, no one's ever going to get on a plane again. No one's going to ever, you know, have an 80-story high-rise condominium again. But, you know, and it took, you know, a year, and things were fairly back to normal, and anybody that sold their stuff on the lows was regretting it. But that's not going to happen this time around. And when you talk about C-level, C-suite guys, I do know for a fact, I know a lot of them, they do need that. I mean, we're social creatures, and they need to be able to look people in the eye, and they need to be able to get people together. And there is there's very good positive things that come of that you actually absolutely lose on the screen. So in this has been a great exercise in your disaster recovery plan, I think.
Yeah.
But at some point in time, you're going to have to get people back together. And now whether that's in, you know, I know a big company that's got a floor or two of the Sears Tower, and I've been going into the city of Chicago a lot since I've been back from Scottsdale. Hey, you know, it took me 2 weeks before I had another guy in the elevator with me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you're only allowed to have four per elevator. How long is it going to take you to get up to the 75th floor of the Sears Tower when there's only four people per elevator? So, I mean, there's so many things that we have to get over. And look, and it's not just the four people to an elevator. It's like, when do you think we can fill an NFL stadium? I mean,
I was going to ask about that too. I mean, thinking about retail environments, we talk a lot about restaurants and the small business owner operator, and that's a worthy discussion, but also big sectors of entertainment like professional sports. I mean, it's been a little bit slow out of the gate for Major League Baseball with the Marlins sidelined, for example, and the confusion or uncertainty still with respect to the NFL and what's happening with youth sports. I mean, again, not professional sports in that way, a revenue generator, but just in terms of the ability of people to work, to have disposable income, to be able to spend it where they used to spend it on entertainment like a baseball game or a hockey game, and where all that goes. And if you did really have long-term entertainment venues shut down or cheap imitations of their former selves, what kind of drag that has on the economy?
Yes. I don't even know what to say to these people, because I had a meeting with a fellow on Tuesday that owns about five restaurants. They do eight figures worth of business a year, and now it's going to be the very low seven figures, right? It's a huge, substantial hit. But he happens to own every single one of his real estate pads, okay? So he's got the business and owns the building. And he asked me what he should do. And I just said, you know what? You're going to bleed cash keeping these things open for 25 to 50% of your revenues, because that's what the governors have allowed you to have come into your front door, until we get through this American battered psyche. I told him, look, I would shut it down to mid-2022 if I was you. I would close it all. Really? If you own the building. Now, there's people around Wrigley Field that are renting space. What are you going to do now? Those established businesses that have been there for eons. I mean, if you have to rent and you have to suffer through this 25 to 50% of your revenues versus paying 100% of your overheads is insane. They're just going to go out of business slower. All the
right
people at the concourse of the Sears Tower, how are they? Those are gone. I mean, all the businesses that are small and don't have chains and don't own their buildings that are in the city, all of these big cities that are relying on the lunch crowd or the Friday afternoon beer crowd, they can't make it. They're just not going to be able to make it. So we have a day of reckoning, or a week or months of reckoning, to kind of get through that, because right now we're still on the sugar high of all the government money, and they're probably going to do something else again. But you can't throw money at this problem until we actually get people willing to kind of come back out of their houses and resume life as it once was.
Well, and the other dynamic too is, so if you have all of those entrepreneurs go out of business and they can't put together the scrap.
They will.
Yeah. I know it's going to be substantial, and I know that nobody knows exactly how much, you know, the projections of 25, 30, 35% of restaurants in big cities like Chicago or New York. I mean, who knows, really?
I really think it's a lot higher than that.
Well, certainly if you're thinking about this, and this could very well be the case, the protocols we're in now in these big cities extending to the end of this calendar year or beyond, well, then certainly it would be much higher. And so if those entrepreneurs can't put together the scratch to open up another shop after all of this clears at some indeterminate point in the future, then you have this other trend line in corporate America, you know, of technological innovation, needing fewer people, wanting fewer people to manage, particularly in tech sectors. And so now you're talking about double-digit unemployment for the foreseeable future. There's not going to be the number of service sector businesses to provide these service sector jobs, and you need fewer people to have the same productivity in manufacturing. You got a problem.
Which means fewer tax revenues and taxes go higher. And they got another problem. I mean, where does this end? You know, when you take that drastic decision, and you started the show with, or the segment with it, when you take that, remember when you're a little kid, you walk into a store and there's a sign, you break it, you own it?
Yeah.
Look, you hit that red button to shut a $21 trillion economy down, you broke it. Now you own it. So that small salon, nail salon in that strip mall that can't pay its rent has to shrug its shoulders and look to the owner and say, I can't pay the rent. And the mortgage, the guy that's got the mortgage has got to look to the bank and say, I can't pay the mortgage. And then the bank has to go to the government and say, you broke it, you own it. You need to start, this money needs to come down this way, because by putting money in people's hands, it's just a short-term sugar high. That's not going to save that sandwich shop or the concourse of the Sears Tower. It's not going to save all those mom-and-pop places around Wrigley Field that have been there for a long time and are established, but they only have 3 or 4 months worth of working capital. They're not going to make it for 6 months. Nobody's going to make it. Nobody could put that in their business plan. So I argued against it from the beginning. I got death threats. But it's such a drastic thing to do to shut the economy down. You can't even imagine the knock-on effects of what it's really going to be in the end.
Well, save a spare bedroom for me in your Scottsdale compound, why don't you, please? Scott the Cow Guy Shalady, Fox Business contributor. Scott, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
See you.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the show. Picking up on our discussion of discussion with Scott Shalady before the break on the recovery, such as it is or might be, the one issue we didn't get to that I want to make sure we tackle is liability reform. This is something that is included in the Senate Republican Phase 4 COVID relief proposal. And of course, Democrats, controlled and financed by the trial lawyers, in addition to the public sector unions, are recalcitrant on the topic of indemnifying businesses who reopen, thus providing another hurdle to reopening and reentering commerce. Washington Times reporting more than 3,800 COVID-19 related lawsuits have already been filed. And this is just after 4 months of action. More than 40 passengers sued Princess Cruise Lines this year, seeking cash payments for the emotional distress they suffered over fear of contracting the coronavirus while on board, even though they never did actually contract it. This is our jackpot justice system that tort reform advocates point to. Examples like this is what they point to when advocating for tort reform. The system tolerates crazy lawsuits, said Philip Howard, chair of Common Good. And if you've never read Philip Howard's book, The Death of Common Sense, from, about 20 years ago, please do so. It's quite excellent. And frankly, the climate has probably worsened since he wrote that book about litigation and our litigious culture. He makes the same point that McConnell has made. The goal is here to instill trust in businesses. If they reopen, they won't be dinged by some lawsuits. While not all COVID-19 cases deal with personal injury or wrongful death, more than 600 of the cases mentioned of the 3,800 involve civil rights disputes, such as court battles over business closure, stay-at-home orders, essential versus non-essential. Howard tells the Washington Times the harm of the current litigation system is not even the total number of lawsuits or the crazy verdicts. The harm is the fear you might get sued in a system that does not reliably prevent it. And so, again, just one more hurdle to jumping back in the water. That's the issue. And so we'll see if anything gets done. We'll see, again, as we talked about earlier this week with Steve Moore and others, against the backdrop of Steve Mnuchin's ridiculous ravings about Keynesian economics, whether or not this is something Republicans cave on the way they did the payroll tax cut. It better not be. Otherwise, you're just in the business of transfer payments. The litigation also pertains to masks. Some restaurants, businesses, restaurants and other businesses that serve the public demand face masks, get sued. Don't demand face masks, get sued. you know, the perfect no-win situation. You demand face masks because otherwise you'll have somebody sue you for you know, negligently creating a hostile public space of public accommodation. You demand them and you get into any disagreement with somebody who makes a claim under the Americans for Disability Act that they cannot wear masks due to health conditions, then you get sued in that way. As attorney Peter Pettish said, we're starting to see it. You're going to get a cadre of attorneys whipping up claims like this over masks, either direction. And eventually we'll see an argument on the need to balance the safety of others against the rights of the individual under the ADA. So, boy, talk about shark-infested waters to navigate. And this goes to schools as well. Schools using the cover story of fear of litigation. You know, you, schools and businesses that lean on their corporate counsels to provide cover for their cowardice. Dr. Redfield testifying on the Hill today, making the pitch yet again. CDC Director Robert Redfield making the pitch yet again for schools to reopen, just as we discussed earlier in the show with Dr. Ladapo from UCLA Medical School, based on a balanced assessment of the benefits versus risks.
How much child abuse will not be detected if children aren't returning to the school?
Clearly, we're seeing less reporting of it. And again, I think it's a direct consequence of the school closures. Well, 7.1 million kids get their mental health service in schools. They get nutritional support, as we mentioned, from schools. We're seeing an increase in drug use disorder as well as suicide in the adolescent individuals. So I do think it's really important to realize it's not public health versus the economy about school opening. It's public health versus public health of the K through 12s to get these schools open. We got to do it safely, and we've got to be able to accommodate.
Well, I appreciate that.
Lives versus lives. Public health versus public health. From the beginning. Lives versus lives, public health from versus public health. It's never been lives versus dollars. It's never been public health versus dollars. This is Dan Proff.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Joe Biden knows how to keep this country strong. He said so on a recent Zoom call. He's back in his basement, yeah, after coming out for just a little while to take softballs from reporters earlier in the week.
On day one, I'm going to send legislation, immigration legislation reform to the Congress to provide a roadmap to citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants and so much that make up so much of our communities and make us so strong.
Right. Illegal immigration makes us strong. Well, if you're going to provide a path for everybody in this country here illegally, we're not talking about dreamers, we're talking about everybody, everybody in this country illegally, then why don't you just scrap the border altogether? That's what he's talking about doing. He's not going to do it through the front door. He's going to do it through the back door, through this path to citizenship rhetoric that sounds so humane and so nice. It's not going to turn out to be any different than what the less subtle members of his team, like AOC and others, the Socialist Spice Girls, who've advocated for defunding Customs and Border Protection, defunding ICE, and eliminating our borders. That's the identitarian politics that is also on the ballot on November 3rd. And for more on that, we're pleased to be joined by Mike Gonzalez, senior fellow at the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, and the author of the new book, The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free. Mike, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hello.
The plot, is it a plot or is it just the full marination of a particular ideology that has captured the left?
You know, the reason I called it a plot is because it is a plot. There are no Thursday night meetings in a basement, okay? But it is the work of a very very, it's small, but very united group of hard left intellectuals and activists who decided, you know, four decades ago, that dividing the nation into groups, into identity groups based on race, ethnicity, sex, sexual orientation, gender, even disability status, would be a way to achieve what they couldn't achieve through revolution, which is to change America from within, to make it accept more of a central planning model, more of a collectivist model. So they created collectives. They got the government to officialize these collectives, these categories, put them on the census, and that is the agent they tried to use to change the country. As that's the case I make in my book. I didn't anticipate we were going to have the summer of 2020, which is a consequence of these the instilling of these grievances. So the book is doing really well for reasons I kind of don't like.
With respect to plotting and the adoption of a particular approach, I mean, based on the manifesto that was put forward by Biden and Sanders in conjunction with one another, Biden fully adopting essentially the Bolshevik Bernie economic vision for America. Do we have finally what folks have talked about for some time, the Cloward Piven strategy being formally adopted by the left, which is to expand the welfare state such to the breaking point so as to usher in the Marxist revolution?
You know, I do mention Cloward and Piven in my book. That couple has been doing damage for a very long time. One of the things that caught my eye was in that essay they wrote in the late 60s, I believe, for the Nation. They said, look, we've never succeeded in these divisions, but now that we have all this money from the Great Society, people will have an incentive to adhere to these groups, and then maybe we can have revolution this way. And I thought that was very clairvoyant of them to write that. So, yes, their strategy, not just the one that you mentioned, but this other one, in saying people, the American people, are after their economic self-interest. Well, now their economic self-interest is in these groups, in adherence to these groups. This may succeed after all.
So remember, the 5th of November was memorializes the foiled gunpowder plot, Guy Fawkes Day across the pond there in merry old England. Is foiling the plot here, remember, the 3rd of November?
Let me leave you first with what I recommend and why I think there's hope. I recommend that the government get out of the business of creating categories in the first place. The government has no business creating the Hispanic category or the MENA category or the Asian American category or the gender categories. And the government has to get out of the business of offering benefits for adherence to these categories, right? So we have to get rid of racial preferences. Once you begin to do that, you begin the hard work of getting rid of identity politics. That's not everything, Dan and Amy. I'm not promising this is the end all of everything, but you begin to do that work. The reason why I'm hopeful is that Marxism always fails because it cannot do what it sets out to do. It sets out to change human nature. You and I know that human nature is unchangeable. So when Marxists fail, they always fail. It's a perfect record of failure. They have to fall back on coercion and violence. I don't think the American people will withstand coercion. They did not withstand it in the 1760s when Britain tried to introduce all these acts. The colonists rebelled. And I think the American people are too attached to liberty to put up with coercion, with cancel culture, with all these things.
I hope you're right about that. You're certainly right about the idea of race-based benefits, something that you're in good company with. Frederick Douglass, 200 years ago, almost 200 years ago, argued against those matters as well. He understood exactly how race-based benefits led to the subjugation of one race at the hands of the other, and that's the business that the government should not be in. So it's very interesting.
He was a hero. Frederick Douglass is a hero of mine.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Well, that I can understand then the basis of the argument. Mike Gonzalez, Senior Fellow, Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. The book, The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free. Mike, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thanks a lot. I wish I knew you when I was young. I could have gotten so high. Now I'm
listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back. A couple housekeeping items to close out the week. Some thoughts. Tony Fauci, this is interesting because it sort of harkens back to this point I made when we were talking to Newt Gingrich the other day about President Trump being very gracious in describing his working relationship with Fauci and Birx and their expertise and their relationship, and noting how it's curious how Tony Fauci has such popularity and high approval ratings, and Trump not so much, particularly in certain quarters, with respect to handling the pandemic. And yet Trump has largely followed the advice of Fauci and Birx. And when he hasn't, on big decisions like shutting down China back in January, Trump turned out to be right. Fauci later admitted it. Interesting. And Trump also being self-effacing in that moment, I noted that pivot and I thought it was very politically shrewd of him. Well, Tony Fauci was asked about that relationship. Did he have the same thing to say about his relationship with Trump and their general agreement on the decisions that have been made that President Trump offered earlier in the week?
By and large, would you say that you and President Trump have been in agreement on most of those decisions?
We were in agreement on virtually all of those.
Well, boy, that's going to be hard for the left and the Never Trumpers to hear that cacophony from Tony Fauci. We were in agreement on those large decisions. Fauci getting into more detail on their agreements in the exchange.
The China ban was very heavily discussed. Were you involved in working with President Trump on deciding to ban flights from China?
Yes, sir, I was.
Do you agree with that decision?
I do.
Do you think that decision saved lives, Dr. Fauci?
Yes, I do.
Do you agree with the decision when ultimately we saw spread in Europe and then the president recommended that we extend that to Europe? Did you participate in that discussion?
I was actively involved in that discussion, sir.
Do you agree with that decision?
Yes, I do.
I'll close with Peggy Noonan, a couple of sentences from Peggy Noonan's column about Never Trumper, since they're still interested in burning down this Trump presidency and the Republican Party with it. Never Trumpers never seem to judge themselves, writes Noonan. Many of them, when they were profiting through past identities as Republicans or conservatives, supported or gave strategic cover to the wars that were such a calamity and attacked those who dissented. Many showed no respect to those anxious about illegal immigration and privately denounced them, sometimes publicly, denounced them as bigots. Never Trumpers eloquently decry the vulgarization of politics, but they have been part of that vulgarization for some time before Trump ever arrived on scene. Some Never Trumpers helped create the conditions that created President Trump's. What would be helpful from them now is not pyromaniac fantasies about constructive, not pyromaniac fantasies, but constructive modesty, even humility. Right. The irony is, for all of their criticisms of Trump's bloviations and his arrogance and so forth, that's what we were subjected to from them for the last 20 years that gave rise to him. And yet they're blind to their own shortcomings, which, speaks to the environment that we're in now. President Trump, Tony Fauci, President Trump, and the Never Trumpers. Much more to discuss on both topics in the coming weeks ahead. 90 days out. Buckle up. Thanks for joining us all this week. We appreciate you tuning in. Please do so again on Monday and have a great weekend in the interim.
From the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.